Good evening. My name is Laura Takachi, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the following co-sponsors, the Department of English, the Office of Student Development, the Office of Institutional and Diversity Initiatives, the Department of American Studies, the Office of Diversity Initiatives, and the Department of Sociology, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, The Art of Writing. Tonight we have with us accomplished and critically acclaimed novelist Colson Whitehead. Throughout his career, he has received widespread praise for his imaginative writing and deft representation of complex racial allegories. In 2002, Whitehead received the prestigious MacArthur Foundation Genius Award, which is given to writers, scholars, and artists in support of their creative work. Whitehead was also awarded a Whiting Writers Award, which is granted to recognize writers of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and plays on the basis of extraordinary accomplishment and future promise. The Intuitionist was Whitehead's debut novel, which the New York Times Book Review called, quote, ingenious and starkly original, end quote. The Intuitionist won the Quality Paperback Book Club's New Voices Award and was a finalist for the Ernest Hemingway Pen Award for First Fiction. Whitehead's second novel, John Henry Days, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, and a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. Time magazine called it, quote, a narrative tour de force that astonishes on almost every page, end quote. John Henry Days earned Whitehead the New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award, a prize which is given to an American author who is 35 years or younger. Other previous novels have received positive reviews in publications such as The New York Times, The Nation, and The Boston Globe. Whitehead's most recent novel, Sag Harbor, explores what the narrator calls the paradox of, quote, black boys with beach houses, end quote. And his upcoming novel, Zone One, will be released in fall of 2011. Whitehead is also skilled in the art of tweeting and maintains an entertaining Twitter feed that all of you can enjoy. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. There will be a question and answer session immediately following the program, so please hold all questions until that time. At the end of the program, there will be a reception and a book signing in the lobby. Books will also be available for purchase. Now please join me in welcoming Colson Whitehead.
Thanks a lot, Laura, for the lovely introduction, and the entire Dickinson community for having me here. The myriad departments enumerated, and all of you guys, especially for coming out tonight. I know it's NBC's sitcom block night. I, for one, am very glad to be here. Usually on Thursday nights, I'm home weeping over my regrets and mistakes. So this is a nice change from what I usually do. I'm going to start with how I got started writing, my journey to this place, if you will, where I'm coming from and where I'm going. And I hope you'll find it entertaining and edifying. I guess I'll start at the beginning. I was born a poor black child. I remember the days sitting on the porch with my family, singing and dancing down in Mississippi. Or maybe that was someone else. I was born and raised in Manhattan. I was a bit of a shut-in. I would have preferred to have been a sickly child, but it didn't work out that way. I always like it when you read a biography of someone like Joyce or whatever, and it says, they were a sickly child and forced to retreat into a world of imagination. It sounds so wonderful. Instead, I just didn't like going outside. Other kids left their houses to do sports, played in the great outdoors. I like to stay inside watching The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. I read a lot of comics and science fiction, and at that age, writing something like The X-Men or Spider-Man seemed like the perfect job. If you're a writer, you could work from home. You didn't have to wear clothes or talk to people. And you could just make up stuff all day. So until I got to college and started reading different kinds of fiction, more contemporary stuff, I wanted to write The Black Shining or The Black Salem's Lot. Basically, if you took a Stephen King title and put The Black in front of it, that's what I wanted to do. But eventually, freshman year, I started hitting the more so-called highbrow stuff, and I liked the equivalency I saw between science fiction and horror and magic realism in Garcia Marquez, the absurd landscapes of Beckett, the mythical terrain of Borges. They played with the fantastic as much as any genre writer. And I think it helps that I've always found Beckett to be a high form of realism. A guy who's buried up to his neck in sand and can't move. He has an itch on his leg he can't scratch. That sounds like Monday morning to me. I considered myself a writer, but I didn't actually write anything in college. I wore black and I smoked cigarettes. But I didn't actually sit down and write. Finally, I wrote two five-page epics that I used to audition for creative writing classes, and I was turned down each time. It was very disappointing, but good training for being a writer, because everyone hates you and doesn't want to read your stuff and ignores you. And if you learn that earlier, you're prepared for when you start sending things out in a more professional capacity. But when I graduated, and I lucked out at a job at the Village Voice, which is a newspaper in New York City, alternative newspaper. It's changed a lot. Basically, the thing about The Voice is that whenever you were there was its heyday, and when you left is when it went downhill. So if you were there in the 50s with Norman Mailer founding the thing, it was great, and then you left, and it went downhill. If you were there in the 70s writing about the birth of disco and hip-hop, that was when it was really, truly outstanding, and when you left is when it went downhill. I was there from 91 to 96, and it was really great. It's a shame what happened to it since then, but I have a lot of memories. It was my job to open, as an assistant in the book section, the 40 books a day we got from publishers. And it was so capricious, the process of reviewing books, what would make it into the paper, what wouldn't. And it was, you know, pretty scary. But the great thing about being at the paper at that time is that you could nag editors to get assignments. And so after the first, 9 months, I started badgering the TV editor. He seemed like an easy mark. And he gave me my first published assignment, which was a wrap-up of the final episodes of Who's the Boss and Growing Pains. I guess no one else wanted to do it. Looking back, I think it stands as a definitive piece on the series enders of Who's the Boss and Growing Pains. And that led to opportunities in the book section, in the music section, and I started writing pretty regularly. And eventually I felt confident enough to start writing fiction. I never learned how to write short stories, so I started with a novel, and from coming out of criticism, it was a very theoretical novel. I was aware of like cliches and what people do with their debut novels. There is the autobiographical first novel, where you get back at everyone who was mean to you. That's a lot of people do that as their first novel. I was writing in the early 90s, so people were doing the Gen X novel, where it sort of opens up, say, in a cafe, and once someone says, "Did you hear what happened?" It's like, "No." It's like, "Kurt Cobain died. He was our JFK." And then it goes from there, generational chronicle. And then there's also the, I guess what I termed the Southern novel of black misery, which I couldn't relate to. It's like, "Oh, I've been walking all day. I have no shoes. It's a dusty road." I'm from New York. I don't know about the South, so I couldn't relate to that sort of mode. So in order to psych out the publishing industry, I decided to write a novel about a Gary Coleman-esque child star who gets abused by the media sphere and has adventures. he's on a TV show. The premise of the show is that he's a black kid adopted by a white family, and the show was called I'm Movin' In, because in the 70s, sitcoms were all about the apostrophe. There was What's Happening, Different, Strokes. And so I'm Movin' In seemed like a sop to realism. I got an agent, and I was very excited, and then we started hearing back from people. So who would have thought that a book about the failed career of a Gary Coleman-esque child star would fail to find its footing in the marketplace? I was very shocked. The rejection slips began to accumulate, and I started to have some really bizarre thoughts. When I first became aware of Top 40 radio, it was during the late 70s, so that meant a lot of disco. The Bee Gees, Diana Ross, Donna Summer. And for years I tried to understand what the song MacArthur Park was about. I grew up on the Donna Summer version. Perhaps some of you are partial to the Richard Harris version with his Irish brogue. I don't know. It wasn't until I started getting all these rejection letters that I started to understand what MacArthur Park was about. And I know that some of you weren't even born when the song debuted, so I brought an audio aid to refresh everybody's memory. The song poses an enigma. Who left the cake out in the rain and why? Was it a birthday party, an anniversary? Some childhood injury finally redressed in adulthood? It wasn't until I got these rejection letters and I sat around in my underwear watching Jerry Springer with the shades drawn, surrounded by Budweiser cans, that I finally got what the song is about. MacArthur's Park is an investigation of the artist's journey. I'd gone to a lot of trouble gathering ingredients, and when I was done, someone left the cake out in the rain. All the sweet green icing was flowing down. I didn't think that I could take it, because it took so long to bake it. And I would never, ever, ever have that recipe again. Knopf Publishing Group, why did you leave my cake out in the rain? Houghton Mifflin Publishing Group, why did you leave my cake out in the rain? Atlas Vanity Publishing of Secaucus, New Jersey, why did you not even return my phone calls? That was so weird. Maybe I wasn't cut out for this writing thing. I started to think about what else I could do. My parents were of that generation that if you were an able-bodied black person, it was your duty to make something of yourself, uplift the race, become a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant. These professions weren't up my alley, so I tried to think of what else I might be able to do. And here I call your attention to my slender, delicate fingers and thin, feminine wrists. I bring them up not out of shame, but to point out that I'm not cut out for certain kinds of work. Far from feeling shame, in fact, I'm quite delighted with myself these days, because we stand at an important moment in our history when a skinny black man with slender fingers and thin feminine wrists has actually become president. So if there's ever a time to be a skinny black man with thin feminine wrists, this is surely it. But back to my hands. These are hands that say pianist, hand model, surgeon. Were these professions I might be suited for? Could I play the piano? Well, let me tell you a little story. The first thing I bought when I got a decent paycheck was an ergonomic chair. I slouch, I can't type, I hunt and peck. With my first book, I had to pop Advil all day because my neck was all messed up from being hunched over. How could I sit at a piano bench without armrests, lumbar support? I could not be a pianist. On paper, being a hand model seems like it must be the life. You get free watches, free hand cream, travel a lot, meet interesting people in the international jet set. But I had a very conservative upbringing. How could I indulge in the model lifestyle? I had read stories about Kate Moss. This was the 90s. So that was out. Surgeon, I was all set to go to med school. Just go down there and sign up, whatever you do. And then I heard about how long operations are. You have to stand on your feet for like 10, 15 hours straight. What if you have to go to the bathroom? I kept thinking about this. What if you have to go to the bathroom? Half the reason I got into the writing business was so that I could sit on my ass all day. So I tried to think about it scientifically. The average book of literary fiction sells 5,000 copies. 5,000 copies, if you're lucky. Now, assuming everyone loves this book, doesn't just throw it in the trash in disgust, and in addition makes 10 other people read it, who also love it, then let's say this book has 50,000 readers. 50,000 people who love it. Well, there are 4.5 billion people in the world. You've made an impact in the lives of 0.00000001% of the population. You're not a gnat trying to catch the attention of an elephant. You're a microbe in the butt of a gnat trying to catch the attention of an elephant. And I know there's some writers who are just starting out, taking workshops here. I just pulled the 5,000 number out of the air. I was trying to Google it before I got here, but it didn't work out. I'm not supposed to Google as much as I do. I'm supposed to go to the library, and Google's digitizing all the books, and one day we're going to stop reading books on paper, but I can't help it because I want Google for everything. I want a Google superego. Like when I'm out drinking and I think, maybe I'll have one more beer, the Google superego will go, did you mean go home right now? Or I'm sitting around and I'm like, oh look, there's a 10-hour Project Runway marathon on Bravo. I'll watch it. The Google superego will go, do you mean read a book and tell your kid how much you love her? It'd be a total killer app. But where was I? The population of Earth, it's very intimidating. Well, what about life on other planets, you might rightfully ask next. Perhaps there is life on other planets, and they have a taste for language poetry, creative nonfiction, or coming-of-age stories. Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but scientists say that the nearest planet outside our solar system is 10.5 light years away, which is pretty far. And the chance of one of our Earth scientists coming up with a faster-than-light drive in our lifetime is quite slim. Estimates about the possibility of life on other planets vary. Some say that only 1 in 100 million planets is capable of supporting life. And what's the chance they would like your stuff anyway? They could be all about the haiku up there, so you're out of luck. So I got very depressed. Jerry Springer, Budweiser cans, shades drawn. And then I thought, maybe it's out of my hands, maybe I have no choice. A friend of mine is a real jerk. He has some fine qualities, but there's no escaping. He's a real jerk sometimes. And for years I wondered how he came to be such a jerk, and one day it occurred to me, evolution. For generations, jerks have been breeding with other jerks to produce more jerks, who in turn breed with other jerks who have litters of jerks in turn. And it must have started thousands of years ago when some Neanderthal jerk got together with another Neanderthal jerk from the next cave over. Perhaps they bonded while fighting over a piece of gazelle meat and just clicked, started talking about the weather. Oh, Gluck Gluck the Thunder God is quite angry today, don't you think? And it was pure chemistry, and they took it from there. And they had a child, and their jerk kid, got together with another Neanderthal jerk's kid, or a Neanderthal of similar type, a moron or a douche. And they had a kid who was half jerk and half douche, and so on for millennia, more or less breeding and concentrating unpleasant qualities until my friend was born. So I figure it's the same with writers. The artistic temperament must go back just as far. There was a Neanderthal who paused while beating in the skull from the Neanderthal from the next cave over, and he thought to himself, hunting and gathering, gathering and hunting. Is that all there is to this miserable life? And he became the first Neanderthal existentialist. And he found a Neanderthal of melancholy temperament, a melancholy female who liked to draw non-representational doodles on the cave wall. And she was the first abstract artist. And they had a kid who didn't like to hunt or gather, but just tell stories all day. And he found a suitable mate and so on, and throughout the centuries, spawning moody, arty kids until, say, in the 1600s, you know, one villager says to another, hey, did you see that new puppet show last night? And the artistic villager says, no, I don't watch puppet shows. I don't even have a puppet show set. I only listen to NPR. And so on to the present day, that artistic DNA surviving, thriving, and getting together. So as I sat in my dirty studio apartment watching Jerry Springer, indeed relating all too deeply to Jerry Springer, I realized that I was the recipient of all that sit on your ass and muse about crap all day DNA. And it didn't matter that no one liked what I was doing. I had no choice, so I got back to work. And it worked better the second time. So I wish that I had had someone to talk to or get advice from when I was starting out. So it occurred to me that maybe I could do something about this for other writers who are coming up. And it also happens that if you're a writer, at some point you have to write and edit an anthology. It's sort of a rite of passage. So a year and a half ago, I started assembling an anthology on the writer's craft. I'm going to call it How to Write and the Art of Writing, Writers Write About Writing. The idea is simple. Today's best writers on the topic of their choice. In short, writers writing about writing. One of the first people to get back to me when I announced this project, I sent out letters to fiction writers, nonfiction writers, editors in the publishing industry, no poets. And one of the first people to get back to me was Jim Phillips, who contributed the following essay I'm going to share with you, How to Write. Jim Phillips, of course, is the author of several works of fiction, including the novels Can't Get There From Here, You Gotta Know When to Fold Them, and the award-winning colloquial phrase I will use as a title. Last year he published the acclaimed work of cultural history, Ding Dang Dong, The True Story of Forever Jaca, Methamphetamine, and Chronic Insomnia. This is Jim Phillips. The art of writing can be reduced to a few simple rules. I share them with you now. Rule number one, show and tell. Most people say show, don't tell, but I stand by show and tell. Because when writers send their work out into the world, they're like little kids bringing their broken unicorns and chewed up teddy bears to class. in the sad hope that someone else will love them as much as they do. And what do you have for us today, Marcy? A penetrating psychological study of a young med student who receives disturbing news from a former lover. How marvelous, have a juice box. And Timmy, what are you holding there, little Timmy? It's a Calvino-esque romp through an unnamed metropolis, much like New York, narrated by an armadillo. Such an imagination, have a juice box. Show and tell, followed by a good nap. Rule number two, don't go searching for your subject. Let your subject find you. You can't rush inspiration. How do you think Truman Capote came to In Cold Blood? It was just an ordinary day, and he picked up the paper to read his horoscope, and it was right there, fate. Whether it's a harrowing account of a multiple homicide, a botched Everest expedition, or a family of colorful singers trying to escape Austria when the Nazis invade, you can't force it. Once your subject finds you, it's like falling in love. It'll be your constant companion. Shadowing you, peeping in your windows, calling you at all hours of the night to leave messages like, "Only you understand me." Your ideal subject should be like a stalker with limitless resources, living off the inheritance he received after the suspiciously sudden death of his father. He's in your apartment pawing your stuff when you're not around, using your toothbrush and stealing all the really cool synonyms from the thesaurus. Don't be afraid. You have a bestseller on your hands. Rule number three, write what you know. Saul Bellow once said, fiction is the higher biography. In other words, fiction is payback on those who have wronged you. When people read my first two books, My Gym Teacher Was an Abusive Bully, and She Called Them Brussels Sprouts, A Survivor's Tale, they're often surprised when I tell them that there's an autobiographical element to them. Therein lies the art, I say. How do you make that which is your everyday into the stuff of art? Listen to your heart. Ask your heart, is it true? And if it is, let it be. Once the lawyers sign off on it, you're good to go. Rule number four, never use three words when one will do. Be concise. Don't fall in love with the gentle trilling of your mellifluous sentences. Learn how to kill your darlings, as they say. I'm reminded of the famous editor-author interaction between Gordon Lish and Raymond Carver when they were working on Ray Carver's celebrated short story, "These Life Preservers Are Just for Show," often considered the high watermark of so-called dirty realism. You'll recall the climax when the two drunken fishermen try to calm each other after their dinghy springs a leak. In the original last lines of the story, Nat, the salty old part-time insurance agent, reassures his young charge as they cling to the beer cooler. "We'll get help when we hit land, I'm sure of it. No more big waves, no more sharks. We'll be safe once again. We'll be home." If you visit the Lilly Library at the University of Indiana and look at Gordon Lish's pages, you'll see how with but a few deft strokes, Gordon pared Raymond Carver's story down to create the now legendary ending, "Help, Landshark." It wasn't what Carver intended, but few could argue it was not shorter. Learn to kill your darlings, and don't be shy about softening them up in the hostage pit for a few days before you do. Rule number five, keep a dream diary. Rule number six, what's not said is as important as what is said. In many classic short stories, the real action occurs in the silences. Try to keep all the good stuff off the page. Some real-world practice might help. The next time your partner comes home, ignore his or her existence for 30 minutes, and then blurt out, "This is it," and drive the car onto the neighbor's lawn. When your child approaches at bedtime, squeeze their shoulder meaningfully, and if you're a woman, smear your lipstick across your face with the back of your wrist, And if you're a man, weep violently until they say, "It's okay, Dan." Drink out of a chipped mug, a souvenir from a family vacation or weekend getaway in better times, one that can trigger a two-paragraph compare-contrast description later on. It's a bit like method acting, but you'll get the hang of it. Simply let this thought guide your every word and action. Something is wrong. Can you guess what it is? If you're going for something a little more pomo, repeat the above, but with fish. Rule number 7, writer's block is a tool. Use it wisely. When asked when you haven't produced anything lately, just say, "I'm blocked." Since most people think that writing is some mystical process where your characters talk to you and you can hear their voices in your head, being blocked is the perfect cover for when you just don't feel like working. The gods of creativity bless you, they forsake you, it's out of your hands and whatnot. Writer's block is like, "We couldn't get a babysitter," or "I ate some bad shrimp." An excuse that always gets a pass. The electric company nagging you for money, your cell provider harassing you. Just say, "I'm blocked," and you're off the hook, no questions asked. But don't overdo it. In the same way that the babysitter bit loses credibility when your kids are off in grad school, there's an expiration date. After 20 years, you might want to mix it up. Throw in a Ralph Ellisonian, "Oops, my house caught fire and burnt up my opus." The specifics don't matter. The important thing is to figure out what works for you. Rule number 8 is secret. Rule number 9, have adventures. The Hemingway mode was in ascendancy for decades before it was eclipsed by trendy pomo exercises. But the pendulum is swinging back, though, and it's going to knock these effete eggheads right out of their Aeron chairs. Keep ahead of the curve. Get out and see the world. It's not going to kill you to butch it up for once. Book passage on a tramp steamer. Rustle up some dysentery. It's worth it for the fever dreams alone. Lose a kidney in a knife fight. You'll be glad you did. Rule number 10, revise. I cannot stress this enough. Revision is what you should have done the first time but didn't. It's like washing the dishes 2 days later instead of right after you finish eating. Get that draft counter going. Remove a comma and then print out another copy. That's another draft right there. Do that enough times and you can really get those numbers up, which will come in handy if someone challenges you to a draft off. When the referee blows the whistle, your opponent goes, 26 drafts, and you bust out with 217 and send them to the mat. Rule number 11, there are no rules. If everyone jumped off a bridge, would you do it too? No. There are no rules except the ones you learned in kindergarten during your show and tell days. Have fun. If they don't want to be friends with you, they're not worth being friends with. And most of all, just be yourself. And that was Jim Phillips. So like I said, I sent out letters to for the anthology to a lot of prominent people in the publishing industry, fiction writers, nonfiction writers, no poets. And I was delighted when the next contributor got back to me. Because no one's been a bigger influence on my work and life, I think, than Constance Dibble. And I'm agreed that she agreed to participate in her own way. Constance Dibble is the author of 2 novels. The first, A Cool, Dry Place, received the Pulitzer Prize. The second, Away from Light, was published exactly 25 years later and also received the Pulitzer Prize, making Dibble the only person in history to receive the Pulitzer Prize for 2 books published on the exact same day, 25 years apart. Last year, she allowed us to tape record her first day of class at Connersville University, and so we're grateful for this glimpse into the workshop experience. This is a recording. Can you reach that window? I find the street noise bothersome. Thank you. I'd like to begin by going around and learning a bit about the group, where you're from, who you like to read. How about you? You seem to be hiding behind your book. What made you sign up for this workshop? Oh, Jesus. To delight and entertain with the highest literary principles, blah, blah, blah. Spare me that crap from the MFA handbook. You knuckleheads better understand something. You're a bunch of worthless snots I wouldn't trust to write a grocery list, let alone a highly acclaimed work of literary fiction. This is the first lesson. Everything you know is wrong. You, where are you from? Secaucus. Only two things come out of Secaucus. Genre writers and creative non-fictioners. I don't see any elliptical non-linear sentences on you. So you must be a genre writer. That right? You write genre fiction? Something a little more literary? Oh, we'll see about that, Missy. Who said that? You have something you'd like to add? So we have a comedian in our midst, huh? Got a sense of humor. You remind me of this guy I used to know in school, Mark Pfeiffer. Wrote Sudden Fiction, thought he had all the answers. Everyone said he was going somewhere, publishing in all the right places. Last I heard, he was selling his Sudden Fiction on eBay to make ends meet. $5, $6 a pop on a good day. Every year, same thing. Coming fresh off the bus and think you know everything. You'll know how easy you got it. We didn't have all these fancy writing programs when I started. No one brought a lunch basket to my studio in a writer's colony. Didn't have no quickie with a cowboy poet in the Yadu library. You know how I wrote my first book? I had three kids and a husband who was good for nothing except sitting on the couch passing gas. I used to write from 5:30 a.m. to 5:35 a.m. every day. Get up, write for 5 minutes, and then take care of the kids. Took me 10 years to write that book. Any of you snot noses think you could pull that off? Okay, you, why are you here? Used to write poetry in college and thought you might want to give fiction a try. Well, how nice of you to bless us with your presence today, Your Highness. At least you got some smarts getting out of that racket. Who wants to be just another trochee sucking misfit? Prose poem? I didn't understand a single word that just came out of your worthless mouth just now. If it has line breaks, it's poetry. If it doesn't, it's prose. It's not that complicated. You know what? Why don't you just get the fuck out of here? Just take your shit and go. Come back when you figure out who you are. Well, that's one down. As you may have heard, I conduct workshop according to craft method. I've been a certified craft method instructor for over 30 years. I was one of D.L. Crawley's final students. That makes me an Omega level craft method instructor. Can any of you mopes tell me who D.L. Crawley was? Pathetic. You are truly the sorriest bunch of wretches I've ever had the misfortune of staring at across conference tables arranged in a U-shape. D.L. Crawley was one of the greatest literary minds of the 20th century. He was Ernest Hemingway's bunkmate at summer camp and was the actual author of In Our Time and The Sun Also Rises. Hemingway stole the manuscripts from beneath D.L.'s mattress one night and published them under his own name. D.L. based Nick Adams on a school chum of his who died during the influenza epidemic of 1918. They were lovers briefly. The story is a kind of eulogy. Well, I see you're paying attention now. A couple years later, Hemingway telegrams D.L. and says he wants to apologize. D.L. agrees to meet him and they have a drink at the Oak Bar of the Plaza Hotel. Hemingway slips him a Mickey and steals the manuscript that D.L. has just completed and which happens to be sitting in his trademark leather satchel. The name of that manuscript? A Farewell to Arms. Actually, D.L. had titled it Silence Spills Across the Ghastly Trenches, and on his deathbed had to admit that his former friend had made the better choice. You know the rest. Hemingway even shot off his own testicle to cover his tracks. That's the kind of psychopathic personality you find on the fringes of the writing industry. The whole affair is recounted in Frank Bellow's The Hemingway Hoax, which we keep on call in the Morton Library down the hall. D.L. could have been crushed by this injustice. No one would have blamed him. But instead, he dusted himself off and opened up the Blue Hills Workshop in the backwoods of North Carolina and dedicated himself to devising the first fully integrated creative writing educational system in this country, Kraft Method. He taught worthy students of fiction for over 25 years until the program busted up. The usual stuff that happens when powerful personalities are locked up together on an isolated campus away from civilization. I was there that final academic year, and D.L. said some things to me. I would have punched him in the balls if anyone else talked to me like that. But of course, D.L. was different. He was the only completely sexual being I've ever come across. Kraft Method consists of 5 discrete modules. See, control your fear. Do you know how many short stories were started last year? 750,000. And how many were completed? 115,000, approximately. What happened to the rest? Fear. Fear of failure? No. Fear of success. Fear of unleashing the creative individual within. R, recognize the artistic fire. In the heart of each of us is a flame. In its natural state, it's the size of a candle. And so it remains for most people. Kraft Method shows you how to feed that fire until it's a great conflagration, consuming all doubt and weakness and converting it into heat and light. The artistic fire. A align the words in their proper sequence. Just as there's a sacred design in nature, so is there a sacred design in every creative endeavor. Learn the underlying order of phrases, sentences, and clauses so that your work may find harmony with this principle or alignment. F, focus your vision. What are you trying to say? Which of the 12 types of characters, the 7 plots, and 4 themes that D.L. described as the deep structure of storytelling best serve your purpose in this tale? What combination thereof? Focus your vision on these essential components and make them work together. Finally, T-tell the world your story. Once you've completed the first 4 steps, you can combine them into that consummate creative act, telling a story. As it was with the cavemen, so is it today. For are we not cavemen still, symbolically loincloth, mere brutes? We still have that primal need to listen to stories and to tell them. Kraft Method. It's not going to be easy. Take a minute to look at the person on either side of you. Chances are they're not going to be here come spring. But for those of you who do make it through, the rewards are immeasurable. Among the successful graduates of Kraft Method are 8 Pulitzer Prize winners, 11 National Book Award winners, and 28 recipients of the Platinum Ink Pot. There's always a kid or two in every class who thinks he's the next Nelson Todd Nelson, but I'm sure you'd be surprised to learn that Nelson is a Kraft Method graduate, never misses the annual picnic. You have to learn the rules before you can break them. You may hate my guts right now, but when this is all over, you're going to thank me and ask me for a blurb. Now, who wants to go first? So that was Constance. I'm very indebted. And finally, one more section, and then we'll have a Q&A, I think. Anytime you take on a project this ambitious, I think is the word, ambitious project such as this, there are bound to be a few hiccups. So you can imagine my surprise when I got this next submission that I'm going to share with you. I sent it to Rick Davis. Rick Davis, of course, is famous for his stories of misfits, loners, and dreamers at the end of their rope, as chronicled in the immortal books Lonesome Ranch, Inc., and Sam Thompson and the Last Desert Roosters Club. But apparently I sent my query to the other Rick Davis, author of the Rick Davis series of party guides. Rick Davis's party guide to New York, Rick Davis's party guide to Vegas, and most recently, Rick Davis's party guide to Ibiza. But there is a place in this volume for unabashed enthusiasm for literature, even from the most unlikely quarters. So here, Rick Davis is going to share his tribute to that touchstone of modernism, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot. Prufrock. Prufrock, I love you, baby, but you gotta lighten up. You gotta chillax. I don't know what set you off last night, but you were really out of control. I grow old. Jesus, I grow old, you grow old. We're all getting older, dude, you gotta roll with it. Was it your birthday or something? I get like that sometimes on my birthday. I want to say something the last time we hung out, but I didn't. It was when we went to that strip club, the one with the mermaid theme. Everyone was having a good time except for you, Frowny. I asked you what was wrong, and you said, I have seen the mermaids giving lap dances, each to each. I do not think they will give a lap dance to me. I was like, just ask, flag him down. That's their job, giving lap dances. But he just kept brooding and pounding beers until you passed out, and we had to carry you to the parking lot, like a patient Jägermeister on a table. Prufrock, I think maybe you should cut back on your drinking. I mean, I totally hear you. It's hard out there on the dating scene. Been a while since I was on the market, but I remember. You tell me about these internet dates you go on, and I thank God I have Betty in my life. Going to a cafe for toast and tea. The women come and go talking about Michelangelo. Sounds rough. I don't know why you keep going after these icy Gwyneth Paltrow types. They're bad news. You gotta find someone who loves you for who you are and stop trying to be who you think they want you to be. Prufrock? Some of the guys say you're the last man of the previous era. Others say you're the first man of the next generation. I say, you're bumming me out and I'm over it. When I first met you, you shook my hand and said, J. Alfred Prufrock, damn glad to meet you. Like you were running for the president of the United Federation of Dorks. Every time I try to give you a nickname, you get all mad and stuff. Al, JJ, Freddie P. There's no shame in these things. They're all perfectly acceptable variations on your own name. Why not The Rock? I'm The Rock. Damn glad to meet you. You say that, you're running for the president of the United Federation of Badass Motherfuckers. This is the love song of The Rock, baby. That sounds totally awesome. And you know what else I think is awesome? You. I just wish you could see it. Last week you were all, I should have been a pair of ragged claws sculling across the floors of silent seas. Admiral Buzzkill reporting for duty. Why do you have to put yourself down like that? You can really have a negative self-image sometimes. I'm going to lend you a book that I got a while back, helped me out of a jam. It's called The Secret. People say, oh, that's just positive thinking. I don't care what you call it. It fucking works. Proof Rock, I'm the best at what I do. I've held my party own with the world's top partiers in all the world's greatest party cities on every continent, even Antarctica, where I blew my mind on fermented polar bear sap, the homebrew of some climatologists of my acquaintance. So I trust you listen to me when I tell you these two things. One, the human race is in a war against global warming and we're losing. And two, maybe you should rethink your approach. Presentation, Prufrock. Presentation is important. We live in a visual culture, but you can't let it paralyze you. You're worried they'll say, his hair is growing thin. Get some plugs. There's no stigma anymore. Remember what my head used to look like? I'm telling you. You're worried they'll say, how his arms and legs are thin. Well, what happened to that gym membership you kept talking about? Let me guess. You went a few times and then started slacking off. Well, if you're not going to be on top of it, who is? People are always going to talk shit about you. There are a lot of haters out there. You should hear what they say about me, but you don't see me getting all bunched up about it. And a lot of women find a bald head sexy because a bald head looks like the top of a penis. Prufrock, start with something small. Get some new threads. Should you wear the bottoms of your trousers rolled? You could do that. I don't even know what you're talking about, but you could do that. You could walk around with your jeans hanging off your butt like all the kids today. Or you could buy a really smart sports coat. Something that's casual but also dressy if the need arises. It's okay to spend some money on it if you're going to get a lot of use out of it. I'm sure Betty would love to tag along. She buys all my clothes. You think I picked this out? I'm a slob. And while you're shopping, you can ask Betty about this doctor she goes to. They're doing remarkable things in pharmaceuticals these days. Micro-targeting areas of the brain. Then there's small talk. Like last night you said, I am Lazarus, come back from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all. That's a great start. A little heavy. It's a little heavy, Prufrock, but it's a great start. Zombies are really in right now. Why don't you rent some zombie movies and use them as a conversation starter at a bar or other social gathering? Like, are you a fast zombie person or a slow zombie person? I'm slow zombie myself, but then I've always been a big fan of the classics. Prufrock, you say classics. You can start talking about jazz, middle period Fellini. You can have that one, the zombie thing. That's a freebie, but then you're on your own. And try to lay off the whole Mr. Intense Gaze thing you do. The ladies find it a little off-putting. I think the big takeaway here is that if you want people to love you, you gotta love yourself first. So go for it, dude. Eat a peach. They're in season. I picked up some nice ones at the farmer's market last week. They were great. Betty loved them. Organic, humanely picked, all that shit. Maybe we can go together. I think they're open today. Let us go then, you and I. Always a lot of chicks at the farmer's market. You can try out that zombie thing. Thanks a lot.
We're now going to begin the question and answer session. So if you have a question, please wait for the microphone to reach you, and either myself or Helen will bring the microphone to you.
Hi, I'm Noor Jahan Akbar. I'm a first-year student here at Atkinson. I have a question about the writing process that you... your writing process. When I write, sometimes my life interferes with my writing. How do you balance those things? Do you let your life influence your writing, or do you keep them separate?
You mean in terms of like day-to-day, I'm having a bad day?
Like just things that happen. Is your writing highly influenced by your daily routine or just events that happen, or are you able to keep them separate? And if yes, how?
Yeah, I mean, it's separate. You know, it's a job. You show up at the computer and, you know, hopefully fulfill that day's tasks. In terms of, I've written good pages when I've been in a bad mood. I've written good pages when I'm in a good mood. I mean, that's sort of separate. If you're asking about how much of like my life is in my work, it varies from book to book. Sag Harbor draws, you know, directly from the bare bones of my life, I guess. I grew up in New York City. I'm going to go out to Sag Harbor, Long Island in the summer. In 85, I was indeed a 15-year-old. But it is fiction. You have to sort of make stuff up to make it interesting. I would, you know, it's not a memoir. I would love to write a memoir if something interesting happened to me one day. Like if I was on a plane and we crashed in the Andes and you had to eat each other to survive. I would totally write about that if we made it back to civilization. But it is fiction, and the higher, you know, aims of the story make what actually happens subordinate. Probably the most autobiographical book of mine is called The Colossus of New York, which is a series of impressionistic essays about the city, sort of free-floating consciousness floating around. And there's just a lot of me in terms of how I feel about the city and people, although it's very anonymous. Things that happen to me serve this story or not that story. My emotional states, how I feel about work, are more or less apparent in different works depending on the needs of the project. Thanks.
I got the impression that The Institutionist, that's one of your books, right?
The Intuitionist, yes.
Yes, okay.
In France, it's The Institutionalist.
Oh, okay, right. I got the impression that it's speculative fiction, right? I haven't actually read the book, but...
It takes place in an alternate reality.
Yeah, yeah.
Speculative fiction and those sort of labels don't really mean much to me, but they are useful for categorizing work, certainly.
Well, I mean, in terms of that, like, category, how do you escape sort of this idea of genre fiction, I guess, that, you know, sort of plagues speculative fiction like, you know, sci-fi and fantasy, or how do you think that you escaped it, if you do think you escaped it?
For me, you know, the different sort of modes I work in are provide different tools of talking about reality. So the detective novel structure, the fantastic elements of The Intuitionist were useful for talking about the evolution of the city, different concepts of race, social mobility. So I used that genre as a tool to address, you know, reality. Coming of age novels, that's another genre that was useful for talking about sort of identity formation in Sag Harbor. So, you know, those, I don't think about those labels. I just pick what I can from here, there. Sometimes it's a capacious narrative voice from, say, Thomas Pynchon. Other times it's a exuberant, joyous narrative voice, say, from Whitman, if that serves a project. So, Those labels are a problem for booksellers and, I guess, librarians. Where do you put things? But I just think, you know, it's all just writing, and that's my sort of one category I think about, and I pick and choose from different modes in order to serve the project at hand. No, I mean, yeah. But don't let that discourage you from talking up in other situations.
Go fast. Yeah, absolutely. When you, sometimes you start something, obviously, and do you always keep it on a back shelf somewhere, or do you just ever throw things out entirely and say, I'm not going to touch this ever again?
Yeah, I mean, like not novels. I mean, the one time that happened, I was halfway through Apex and put it down for like 2 years. When I came back to it, I couldn't relate to the character, so I had to change it. I have a few things lying around. I was mentioning today in a class visit. I have a weird kid's book no one seems to like. It was fun to write. It was like, you know, I thought about it for many years, but the actual writing of it was only like 2 weeks. So it's served this artistic function for me, and I don't really care if it gets published or not. And I consider myself a novelist, so I would definitely have a hard time putting novels aside. You know, the first book I mentioned in my first talk, everyone hated it, no one's going to publish it, so I had to sort of move on. And that was a big moment in my life, knowing that I wasn't going to get a straight job and become a lawyer or a vet or something like that. I just had to start the next book. And then maybe next time people will get it, or the one after that. And each time I start a new book, I'll get better, hopefully. So from the book that failed, like, I've taken like 3 similes from it over the years. It would take a lot of time to bring it up to my present standards, and that's time better spent brooding or working on something new. If my daughter has like a big gambling habit when she's 30, maybe she can like sell it or something and pay off her bookie or something.
Feel free to let us know when you have a question at any moment.
Do you find it to be detrimental to be just keep on writing, just spend hours and hours doing it? And do you find that you get tunnel vision and you need to step away from being a writer and do other things for a while to keep it fresh?
No, but I take a lot of time off in between things. I mean, like a year or a year and a half between books, and where I'm just sort of hanging around and hopefully soaking in ideas and inspiration. You know, the day, sometimes it's a 2-hour day or a 4-hour day or 4 hours, and you take a break for dinner and come back. It's what, you know, you feel like doing. In terms of how I get these things done, I made a joke about someone who writes like for an hour every morning or 5 minutes every morning, and some people can do that. I need like the whole day free. If I have a doctor's appointment like at 2, the whole day shot, I can't, I don't start, you know. But if I have 3 or 4 days free, you know, and if I can get maybe 8 pages a week, it adds up. And it could be like a 1 page a day on Monday, and then maybe 2 on Thursday, and then 3 on Saturday, and then catch up on Sunday. Some days you don't feel like working, so you don't. Tunnel vision, if I'm stuck, it's the next day. You know, these things take years, and so you can only do what you can each day, and it accumulates.
Hi. I was wondering about the relationship. You've obviously read a lot, and I'm curious about the relationship between what you read and what you write. Do you seek out or avoid certain kinds of work when you're in sort of writing mode, or is it a kind of ongoing?
Well, I mean, I find it hard to read fiction, definitely, when I'm writing a novel. I'm also just tired and don't want to read at night. So I read generally more weird nonfiction, like History of U-Boats or like Salt. If you put like a one-word noun in a title, like I'll probably read it eventually. And then, you know, I guess when I think of books that stay with me or I like talking about and teaching, it's because they've instructed me in some lesson in structure or something like that. With Sag Harbor, where there's not really strong linear plot, how do you keep people going over the course of the book when there is not that sort of narrative, the element of narrative gratification? Well, hopefully Benji, the narrator, is perceptive enough, funny enough, and winning enough that you want to stay with them, even though there's not a lot of action in the book. And there are, you know, in terms of like the modular structure where the chapters have a complete idea or a theme they're exploring, but work in concert and not really short stories. That's, you know, say in Junot Diaz's Drown or Winesburg, Ohio. Spoon River anthology? Like, how do you create meaning out of different modular components? So I think of those books as instructive in creating structure where there is no structure. A lot of stuff I encountered in college, you know, was really great. The modernists, various post-World War II writers, that's sort of like, you know, the folks that definitely were a big influence on me. And then I think everything you do and see ends up serving the work as an influence, whether it's music or film. Oh, and there's someone up there. If you can. All right, sure.
If you had, like, just to say, like, one piece of advice, like, something that would look good on, like, a poster or something, just, like, a piece of advice for basically writing, like, what would you basically say to, like, some budding writer who just needs some sort of guidance?
Just keep going, because no one cares about you or wants to give you any support, so you have to figure out how to do yourself. That's true for me now. Like, when I have a novel, who am I going to give it to? Who wants to read, like, 400 pages of unedited nonsense from me? And then when you sit down at the desk each day, it's just you having to figure out how you're going to put things down. And you only get better by doing it. So just keep going. You write a crappy story, and the next story is a little bit better. And then you'll regress, and then you'll read something that's inspiring and get a little better. And so you can only get improved by failing and then trying again and then keep going.
Hello. I teach legal writing sometimes to law students. And one of the things that I've noticed is that the lack of emphasis on basic grammar and sentence structure at an early age certainly affects your ability to write clearly as a lawyer. I'm just wondering, in terms of fiction and creative writing, if you think those skills are important as a basis also.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, certainly. But I think in terms of writing well, the best thing that happened to me was working for a newspaper, because, you know, there's a house style, and writing every week, writing in public, if you write a crappy article, you hear nothing. If you write a good article, you get positive feedback. And so that really taught me how to write. And also, there were finer points about the subjunctive, which somehow eluded me until I got out of college. So, but yes, a basic command of grammatical rules is always a plus.
Hi. I think it was in an article you wrote for Harper's Magazine when you talked about how you receive lots of publications to read each week and how most of them are frustratingly clunky, and how every now and then you'll find a piece of writing that's pleasantly surprising. What I'm wondering is, have you always known how to distinguish good writing and bad writing, or is that something that you learned? Is that something we can all sense? Or, yeah, that's basically
Yeah, I mean, well, the Harper's piece was a parody of a sort of pompous critic talking about what's good writing and, like, what's a perfect sentence, the elusive unicorns that come by your desk. For me, I mean, you develop taste over time, and maybe it's your own personal taste. Perhaps it's, you know, applies to most people, or the critical establishment is in accord with the general idea of what a good sentence is or a good book. So I think it's more important to just like what you like and learn what you can from the kind of fiction literature that drives you, compels you, nonfiction, poetry. And that's the most important thing, is your own taste. You can read science fiction, romance, thrillers, literary fiction, military histories, and that's what, you know, it's your life, that's what you want to read. You should enjoy it.
You brought up the subject of revision and how important it is to the writing process, and I'm just wondering, I think that's something that a lot of writers struggle with, and how you know what is too little revision and when a piece becomes overworked. When do you feel that a piece is finished, and how do you know?
Yeah, I mean, overworked doesn't occur to me that much. It's not done if you keep finding things wrong with it. I mean, I know if you're in a writer's workshop and you get too much input and you don't know what to take, what to throw out. So for me, I know when a book is done, when I just like take one comma out and then it's like the next day I put it back in and I can just flip through it randomly and not want to change an adjective or cut that clause. So I've worked it over enough times that when I open it, the decisions or the things I'm worried about are so little and stupid, like should this comma be here or not, that I have to have someone else have a shot at it and tell me. So then, of course, you think it's done, and then you look at it a month later and you find mistakes. And so having that sort of time calculated in where you can get some distance and then see with a fresh eye is also important.
Hello. Every author deals with the problem of the blank page. How do you start writing? Do you have an idea, or do you just kind of go with it, or?
I plan out my ideas like pretty, as thoroughly as I can before I start working. So, like, I need an outline. I can't just wait for the muse, to come knocking. So, beginning, the end, different characters, what they're going to do. Is this character, someone who's important in the book? Is this someone who just provides information? When do I describe the main character's house? When do I describe Main Street? And as I work, things become more or less important, but I have to know sort of what is going to happen. And I guess my theory is that it's hard enough to find the right words each day. If you also don't know what's going to happen, it seems twice as hard. So when I start work, I'm like, all right, I'm finishing the scene from before, or I'm describing the sheriff, or here's Lila Mae's flashback about her upbringing. And then I can figure out how to say it, but I know each morning what I have to accomplish or try to attack.
Hi, I was just wondering, when you're writing about a character that you don't personally like, how do you find a way to keep a distance from that character? Because I know you spoke a lot about how fast and easily you can fall into an obsession of plot, theme, and the character, but how do you keep a distance so that your personal opinions don't reflect on him or her?
Well, I mean, they're not people, they're characters. I'm not invested in how they feel. If they're racist, sexist, or killed 100 people, they're just characters. And so they do what they have to do in order to serve the story. And I'm not judging them. Is that what you sort of meant?
Yeah, but my question is, how do you distance yourself enough not to judge them?
Because they're not real people. they don't owe me money. They finish off the coffee and leave me with nothing. They're just, the characters are the same as the buildings and the same as the streets. They're just made out of sentences and words.
Hello. You might have answered this earlier from the question up yonder, but I was wondering maybe on a deeper level. When you kind of get that eureka moment, or this is something that I feel really compelled to write about, is that eureka moment plot-based, and then you kind of shoehorn compelling characters into that plot, or rather do you think of a really compelling character and then build a plot around that character?
With Sag Harbor, it was a situation and who's going to populate the town. With my first couple books, it was an intellectual problem I wanted to solve. With John Henry Days, the folklore hero, steel-driving man, how do I update this industrial age anxiety myth for the information age? So that's a proposition or a question with no character. So how can I invent characters, find a setting to accommodate the ideas I want to grapple with? So the book, depends on the book. My new book is a horror novel and it has a premise. And there's a premise. Basically, everyone's dying and there's apocalypse. So there's not actual something I wanted to solve, but I think in the same way, Sag Harbor is about a kid who remains hopeful and optimistic at the end of the book, even despite disappointments big and small. This horror apocalyptic novel is about someone who embraces pessimism despite the fact that things are getting better. So in those two cases, I have a character in a certain situation, and how does it play out realistically, and how can I use the character to talk about the things I want to talk about?
What are some of your favorite ways to procrastinate?
To procrastinate. There's napping, weeping, walking around. But I think the best way is just not to work. I just watch TV and like don't avoid thinking about what I have to do. It's pretty easy to not work. But I am home-based, so things I can do in my home, you know, which is a variety.
Do you have any advice on how to find an editor for your work?
Well, I can talk about how I did it, which is not write a bad book. So that was the first thing I learned. Like, no one liked my first book, and it was really just about me exploring certain ideas, but not really thinking about how to make a story out of what I wanted to write about. I sold The Intuitionist because there was someone who had passed on my first book, and then once my agent dumped me, because no one wanted to, I was obviously a losing prospect, I was like, what do I do? I'm writing this book about elevator inspectors, what do I do? And she said, well, when you're done, send it to this one person, she's new and is taking on clients. And so I did, and Nicole Araji is her name, and she sort of got it immediately, and then she sells the book. I mean, I don't want to think about that stuff, I just want to write the things. So most people have agents in order to get get it to an editor. An agent knows which editor, which house buys the kind of thing you wrote, who's going up, who's down, which publishing house is about to go bankrupt. So they know all the stuff you don't know because you're just in your house writing. They know the exact people to send it to.
So The Intuitionist kind of messed with my head, and I wanted to ask you, why elevators?
Sure. I was trying to do something linear and plot-based because my first novel everyone hated. So it seemed like if I borrowed from the detective novel structure, the election year, the hitmen, the corrupt mayor, a.k.a. head of the Department of Elevator Inspectors, and if I thought about red herrings and characters who betray you and parceling out information to create a suspenseful narrative, I might learn how to do that. And I thought it would be funny if an elevator inspector had to solve a criminal case, like fish out of water, and then somehow someone who is a inspector or detective in a certain kind of way has to solve a criminal case. But of course, there are no skills from elevator inspection that would carry over to forensics and whodunit. So it became all about elevators, and I had to invent an elevator world. Where do they work? How do they talk? Where do they learn it? Well, they have to invent a school. Where are there different disciplines in the school? So I had to invent a conservative and a progressive branch. And then, each time you figure out something, another problem. What's the landscape of the school? What are the names of the teachers? Where did she live? Lila May. But you're building a world, all along. And that's where I think, for me, outlining comes in. I'm not just... So then what happens? I actually know that I'm going to have four sections set in the school. And three or four sections that are extracts from theoretical elevators. And that makes the mythology of the world and makes it more real for you and makes it plausible that elevators are really important when they're perfectly fine in this world, but how do you sell them for a whole novel?
Yeah, I have a two-part question. The first is, do you have an indispensable author? I don't necessarily mean your favorite author, but somebody that even that you're sort of doing battle with in an artistic sense. And then the second part is, what about guilty pleasures, things that you read that aren't necessarily literary but have powered your fiction in some way?
Yeah, there's no one, you know, I feel in combat or, you know, anxiety influence about. They, you know, at this point, I just do my own weird thing, and I feel comfortable with what I'm doing. And then people I used to like, I'm sort of sick of, and then, you know, you have to rediscover them. So, and then in terms of guilty pleasures, I mean, there aren't guilty. I think you can like Nathaniel West and what I've read, you know, like in a day, the Stieg Larsson books, which are totally implausible, they're not well written, they don't make any sense, but they're completely compelling, you know, it's like a bag of potato chips, you can't stop reading them. There's great emotional closure when it spends like 100 pages, like bringing the villains to justice, and it's totally implausible, but it's like, yeah, you know, get that child molester. So they didn't teach me anything, but they were fun to read, and definitely, you know, the so-called genre stuff I read as a kid, horror and fantasy and science fiction, definitely helped me along. I don't see, you know, I was talking about this before in the class visit, and I guess also here too, like Beckett's landscape and Waiting for Godot is a science fiction, it's Mars. You know, it's not in the real world. And he's just using this tweaked reality to talk about how we actually live. So all these things are just tools, high realism, fantasy, that I feel I can draw on for work. And then the stuff that I just like to read for kicks might not be instructive, but you know, it brings a lot of joy.
This will be our last question.
Okay, you're obviously very funny. Jokes in the bank. But do you ever find that your sense of humor pigeonholes you in any way or precludes you from entering certain literary circles?
No, I mean, you know, like, what's a cool literary circle? There's a bunch of losers. I mean, so, you know, some books are funny, some books aren't funny. The Intuitionist is very straight-faced. Sag Harbor gives me a lot of latitude to have a lot of jokes. My new book is about the apocalypse and 95% of the population dying. There's not a lot of jokes. So sometimes I can get my satirical view of the world in. Sometimes it's not appropriate. If it's not appropriate, then it can't go in. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Colson Whitehead one more
time. Thank all of you.